Welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Today we'll continue with reading from The Ice Dancer, read to us by its author Connie Ellis of Duluth. The Ice Dancer takes place someplace north of Two Harbors up in Canada and includes wilderness lakes, saunas, and opera-loving sled dogs. Continuing now with The Ice Dancer.
Several fresh deer tracks cross her front yard. Nothing unusual about that, but she senses something and walks down to her dock and looks across the expanse of White Deer Lake and listens to the silence of the Canadian winter. The white emptiness on such a sunny day usually gives her much peace and satisfaction, but today she feels an ache in her heart, which she is sure has nothing to do with Dr. Winkle. She stands on the dock for a long time in the cold, waiting for something, though she doesn't know what. Inside, everything looks the same. She writes on her calendar, "I'm becoming part of snow." Greta waters the plants, writes a note to Fawn, then quickly packs. She'll stay a day or two, depending on how she feels, but she'll definitely stay over at least one night. She carefully slips the small square window into a cardboard mailer, seals it well, and writes Dr. Winkle on its front with a blue felt-tip pen. She packs the second, the round window, to take to Winnipeg. She'd like to find an outlet there. Thunder Bay is so far, takes all day to get down there. She doesn't have the attachment to the town or Lake Superior that Fawn has, and doubts she'll develop one, especially since Dr. Winkle's office is so near the art co-op. As she's about to leave, she looks back at the rooms of her cabin and wonders, as she always does when she's going further than just into Red Otter, if she'll ever come back, if she'll ever see her cabin again. Will she ever have her sunny workroom she's so looking forward to? She lingers a moment. The winter sunbeams on the oak floor are perfectly beautiful today. They always remind her of a dance studio. Today, the sunbeams seem like ghosts. She shuts the door quietly and makes two trips to the car with her suitcase and the stained glass pieces. She hoists a heavy bag of sand from the garage into the truck, tucks in the snow shovel, and tosses an old gray wool blanket on top of everything. Tom has started chopping wood. He usually doesn't chop on Sundays. He must be feeling better, making up for lost chopping time. She catches a glimpse of Rosie's pink winter jacket slipping through the pines and poplars, sees her stop and stand still, trying to hide behind a pine as Greta drives past. Greta stops at Fawn's mailbox, slips the note inside, and flips open up the flag. She doesn't want to waste time, since the forecast is for continuing fair and sunny weather today, with colder temperatures and a possible storm moving in sometime tomorrow. She can easily make it to Winnipeg before dark if she leaves right away and makes good time. Once in town, she intentionally drives past Darrell's, spots Dr. Winkle's bright yellow Carmen Ghia parked in the driveway. She wants to be sure her imagination hadn't played tricks on her, and yes, the car is as yellow as she had thought. She leaves the stained glass window at Don's Grocery with Mrs. Don, who says she'll give it to Dr. Winkle if he comes into the store, but she's not going out of her way to let him know it's there. Dora Don tries to warn Greta, says he's a real odd duck. Greta readily agrees and assures Mrs. Don that he's perfectly harmless, just a real odd duck, just as she says. She buys a package of chocolate-covered raisins, her way of measuring the distance when she drives by herself. Every 10 kilometers, she gets one raisin, or she waits and has three every 25 kilometers. On the road, by 13 raisins, she's on the north edge of Winnipeg and needs to stop for a restroom. Plus, she needs a drink. She spots a new store, a natural health food store, just off the road near the sign to Loon Lake. Or perhaps it isn't new. She just hadn't noticed before. But she comes to Winnipeg so seldom these days, she can't tell what's new and what's old. A new bright sign decorated with hand-painted fruits and vegetables reads, "Northern Natural Food Store for a Happy Heart and a healthy spirit. They're ready to close for the day, but the two women in the store seem in no hurry and let Greta in to use the restroom and buy what she needs at her leisure. The restroom is in a corner of the storage room, neat, tidy, and smelling of sandalwood. Back in the commercial section of the store, she chooses organic apple cider and an alfalfa sprout and cheese sandwich on 12½ grain bread while listening to the two women discuss a play about a family who live in an organic garden. She'd like to see this play, she tells them when she sets her items down on the counter, says it sounds very interesting, and asks who the playwright is. The tall lady laughs and introduces herself as Snowbird, says she's writing the play. She hasn't quite finished the first act, but is glad it interests Greta. The other woman is Tia, who says the apple cider is pressed from the Macintoshes from her orchard, that each year she adds 3 trees to her orchard, and this is her first commercial venture with the trees, and she hopes Greta enjoys it. Greta looks over the leaflet about the moonwalk while Tia rings up her purchases. Tomorrow night, Tia says, it'll be a wonderful moonwalk if we beat the storm that's supposed to move in. Idas might come, Greta tells the woman, whom she feels an immediate affinity with. She slips a flyer into her purse. We meet right here at 7:45 for cider, then we leave for the walk around Loon Lake at 8 o'clock. Come if you can, we'd love to have you, Snowbird calls out as Greta leaves the store. She's been noticing the moon more as the years go by. She likes to think of it as the same moon that shone down on her as a child, that shines down now on the graves of her parents, and will someday shine above her own final resting place. Maybe Gabriel's tomb is in a cemetery in Winnipeg. She could go to a cemetery office and ask. They would give her his grave number and a map, and she could wander around the cemetery grounds, hunting in the snow, over hills, past markers and statues. He would be near tall birch trees covered in snow, and she would know before she saw his stone, before she saw his angel, that she had found him. You all right? Tia asks, coming out of the store. She's locked up behind her for the night. Greta doesn't know how long she has been sitting in the parking lot and is startled at herself. She rolls her window down a bit. Fine, I'm fine. Just taking a little rest before I drive into town, she says. Tia looks into Greta's car. I'm not so sure. Here, you take this. She hands Greta a card. Call me. I don't care what time it is. You just call me if you need someone to talk to. Thanks, Greta says to this kind woman, who she knows means exactly what she says. Tia pats the car windshield in lieu of Greta's shoulder, then watches Greta drive out to the Winnipeg exit. Greta drives toward Winnipeg, thinking of the women, the ancient moon, and just what the 1/2 grain in the 12½ grain bread might be. Greta checks into a motel where she has stayed before, the Snow Palm, knowing she wouldn't need a reservation at this time of year. The Snow Palm is clean, reasonable, has a restaurant, and a good-sized and well-maintained whirlpool spa. She hangs up her clothes, organizes her toiletries, and pours the apple cider into the coffee maker to heat. She throws all the pillows onto one bed, drapes a bath-sized towel over the TV, and by the time she's unwrapped her sprout and cheese sandwich and kicked off her shoes, the cider is hot. Delicious! What a stroke of luck to discover the health food store, and it's comforting to know she has Tia's card in her purse, someone she could call any time. Funny, she really could talk to Tia if she had to, if she needed to, and as friendly as she is with Fawn, and they've been friends for over 5 years, it's this new person, Tia, she could talk to about Gabriel. Not that she will. Still, it is nice that she could. Before she met Fawn, it was always hard for her to be friends with women, although she had always had women friends and girlfriends when she was a child. Yet she always felt more comfortable, more at home with men, whether they were lovers or platonic friends. They were more straightforward and kind, she thought, less silly and jealous. There were so many jealousies back in her dancing days, and she was often the cause, especially with Violet. Violet hated Greta's close friendship with Gabriel. In class, if Gabriel chose Greta to partner him, Violet fumed. She changed color like a chameleon. Her eyes darkened and her skin took on a ruddy flush. Violet was a person of extremes, not only in her jealous rages, but in her outrageous laughter, her funny pranks, her energy as a dancer. She and Violet were even friends for a time. They used to have great fun doing playful variations of their dance routines after rehearsals. Sometimes they had picnic lunches in the park near the zoo with Gabriel and took long, quiet walks along the river to listen to the birds. Violet was good at identifying several species of theirs by their song, and Greta could whistle the chirp of the robin, song sparrow, and red-winged blackbird. Violet did the loon. Her loon call is the only thing Greta still remembers with any fondness. Then, in the late fall, Greta and Gabriel started to avoid Violet. Now, neither Greta nor Violet dance. Violet married their first-year dancing coach, the one they called the Praying Mantis, and now she is working on a degree in business. Greta wouldn't have been at all surprised to hear Violet was in theater, if not dance, but business. That really surprised her. It was last fall when she ran into Violet outside the Winnipeg Library that she heard about Gabriel. With no preliminaries, Violet came right out and told Greta that Gabriel was dead. Greta thought her heart would stop right there on the library steps. She fought back tears as they walked down the stairs. She kept saying something about how young they were, and Violet talked about his headaches, and she said heartaches by mistake and quickly corrected herself. Greta didn't really hear anything Violet said after that. She only heard sounds, though Violet kept talking all the way to the bottom of the stairs, where she got into a cab with her briefcase. Greta remembers the finality of the cab door slamming, how it was like the closing of a coffin. She had continued to walk along the sidewalk as if in a vacuum until she passed someone smoking a pipe, and the sweet smell of tobacco was all she could think of. And Gabriel did, the strong incense of pipe tobacco, and walking along the sidewalk. She kept walking, paying attention to the cement of the sidewalk, the cracks in the cement, the leaves, red maple leaves all along one block. She had stopped to look up at a particularly bright tree, a maple, on the corner before her parking lot, and stood there shaking and looking up at the branches of the tree, waiting for leaves to fall. Like a crazy person in the big city, she knew even then, and later, thinking about it, she was afraid she had put her hands out to catch the leaves as they fell, but hoped she hadn't. She was frozen in a little shell of space that afternoon. She didn't want to live, of that she was sure, and also, just as sure, she would never tell anyone, not even Tia, how it was for her then, in those nightmarish long fall days. She slips on her bathing suit, grabs the big towel off the TV, heads down the hall, walking barefoot along the red and brown carpeted hallway to the spa. Two men with big stomachs are in the water. She steps into the corner of the hot tub furthest from them. Very warm, very good. She lets her legs float out in front of her. Her right knee is sore from the drive. She loves to float in the center of these bubbling pools. She'll float when the stomachs leave. They're talking about pike and walleyes, ice fishing and rotten ice, muskies. The man with the hairy chest is telling the bare-chested man he can keep going on a couple of suckers all winter. He threads a fine wire just under the skin, can't hit the backbone, and then he reuses them if they don't get eaten. Greta feels herself nearly gag at the story of sucker bait, but the hairy guy starts stretching, so she knows they'll leave soon. The bare-chested man looks at Greta, trying to think of something to say. "We nearly sank," he says finally, "our truck, that is, out on Huron Lake, ice fishing. Ice cracked right under us," he laughs. "Woo, glad to be here, I'll tell you. You from Winnipeg?" he asks Greta. "No," she says, look in the other direction, but still she is glad they didn't sink. She has always thought going through ice and drowning in ice water would be the worst thing that could happen to a person. The two stomachs talk quietly among themselves, but Greta can hear they're talking about getting a pizza, and should they get sausage with snuff or rabbit and scones, it sounds like, but she knows she's not hearing right. They climb out of the tub and walk away in their soggy towels. The friendly one who told her about the truck looks back and waves before disappearing around the corner. Greta steps into the center of the tub, lies back into the water, and floats in the bubbles. Chapter 16, Night of the Full Moon. I feel sure that the surface of the moon is not perfectly smooth, free from inequalities and exactly spherical, as a large school of philosophers considers, but that, on the contrary, it is full of inequalities, uneven, full of hollows and protuberances, just like the surface of the earth itself. Galileo, from the Starry Messenger, 1610. Have you ever seen a blue moon? Bobby asks Dave. Seen a couple. Blue moons, hunter's moon, black cherry moon, wolf moon, strawberry moon, that's June. Every month's got a different name. Harvest moon. The blue moon's different, though. It's two moons in one month. That's not every year. You got a thing about blue? Dave asks. Yeah, like the bowerbird. You know about the bowerbird. The male collects blue things, blue feathers, string, beads, any blue stuff, bits of plastic, anything. He keeps it like an art collection. The female bowerbirds go for blue. Whoever has the most blue wins. No kidding, Dave says. You made that up. No, look it up. Any in Canada? Australia. I think they're in Australia. Bobby and Dave drive for a while, thinking their respective thoughts of blue. They're about 20 kilometers north of the health food store, where they are headed for the moonwalk around Loon Lake. You know, we could call the CD Blue Barns, Bobby suggests. Paint one of the really big barns blue for the cover, a real tall one. Or maybe fine with a blue door, very eye-catching. No, it's got to be Ghost Barns, Dave says, rather hurt that Bobby could even consider changing names. The whole idea is ghosts, you know, the ghostly wind blowing through the barns. Blue doesn't have anything to do with it. Oh, what the hell, I was just thinking aloud. We'll keep Ghost Barns. Blue Barns is too weird anyway. I mean, sick weird, not blues or jazz, anything like that. It's just weird. The more I think of it, the more it gives me the creeps. That's why you never see a blue barn. He looks over at Dave to see his reaction. The animals would get sick, he adds. Ha, you're getting carried away, Dave tells him. It's 'cause you write songs, adding one thing and another thing, getting all worked up. That's getting into poetry, like Dylan. But he has seen a blue barn, Maynard Matheson's, and his silo is blue too, but he won't tell Bobby. They're now about 10 kilometers north of the health food store. Dave runs his finger along the top edge of the manila envelope beside him for the umpteenth time. It contains an 8x10 inch photo of the great horned owl that lives in the woods behind his house. He took the photo at night as the owl raised his wings straight up and out, as only owls can do, and Dave thinks they look like angel wings. Out of probably more than 50 attempts, this picture turned out so good. Dave could hardly believe it. He took so many shots, he couldn't figure out what he did differently that made it turn out so well. Most of the owl photos were just all dark, sometimes with a blurry white spot, or on a few the eyes showed up. He was incredulous when he developed this one. So professional, he can still hardly believe he took it. He won't tell Tia about the bad ones. Deer in the ditch, Bobby says. 2, no, 3. Dave slows down, passes them cautiously. Bobby sings quietly to himself, a line that's been coming to him all day. My love is made of snow, snow, snow. When winter ends, she melts. At winter's end, she melts. He can't settle on the last line. At winter's end she dies. When winter ends, she's gone. No, at winter's end she melts. More positive. He's restless. Knows this line won't let him alone until he has it right. Till he's written it down. Figured out the chords. Another sleepless night, he sighs. That's the full moon for you, Dave says, turning into the parking lot at the health food store. You sure it's okay if I come, Bobby asks, suddenly shy, since I didn't sign up or anything. Sure, it's fine, Dave says as he opens the door of the store and is greeted by the welcoming aroma of spiced cider and the warmth from the wood-burning stove. Snowbird does a subtle but noticeable double-take at Bobby in his blue mohawk. She greets Dave warmly, and two girls in jeans, one with a blonde ponytail and the other with a long black braid on her back, they must be 9 or 10, bring cider and offer oddly shaped molasses cookies. Some of the cookies are small and hard-looking, about the size of 50-cent pieces, and the rest are big and lopsided, partially rounded with one flat edge from being placed too close together on the cookie sheet. Dave takes a small cookie and thanks the girls, figures he can dip it in the cider if it's too hard to bite. They stand next to the stove, drinking cider, and Dave wonders where T is when he hears a car door slam. Bobby twists the screw in his earlobe as Snowbird comes up to him. She's as tall as he is. That's infected. You had to take that out, she says. Matter-of-factly. She wants to ask about his blue mohawk, but doesn't want to seem too nosy. I'm in a band, a rock band, he offers. We have to distinguish ourselves from the other groups. Otherwise, we're all the same, and no one can remember us. I've been thinking of getting rid of the screw. There's some rubbing alcohol and cotton in the back. Snowbird starts toward the back of the store. Come on, she calls over her shoulder. Bobby follows. The blonde girl offers a forked tree branch to Dave. It's a cocoon, she tells him. We don't know what kind, though. I am hoping it's a monarch. They eat milkweed leaves. That's probably a morning clerk. That's what my mom thinks, the braided girl says, peering closely at the cocoon. Snowbird's my mom. Dave examines the cocoon. It looks like some of the things that grow in leftovers in the back of his refrigerator. He wishes he had his camera. He's never taken pictures of people, but he'd like to take a picture of these girls with the cocoon. He asks their names. Snowbird's daughter with the long braid is Tara, and the blonde is Priscilla. They're in the same class at school, where Snowbird teaches 3rd grade, and Priscilla's father teaches 6th. They're in 5th grade this year, and come on the moonwalks whenever it's not on school night. Hi, Dave, Tia says, closing the door quietly behind her. I thought you might come. Did you see the moon? Well, no. Guess I was preoccupied. But I'm ready. No sign of the storm yet. Tia hugs Tara and Priscilla at the same time, an arm around each. Dave wants to be in the hugging group, which Tia appears to take note of. She helps herself to a cookie while Tara pours cider, and Dave hands her the envelope with the owl photo. He'd like to give it to her privately, but he can't wait any longer. Should I open it now, she asks. Yes, it's an owl, he tells her before she can slide the picture out of the envelope. Everyone gathers around the photograph of the owl with the big eyes and great raised wings, and they all seem to like it, even Snowbird and Bobby, who come up behind Dave from the infirmary. Bobby's earlobe is covered with a small round bandage. Snowbird said he captured the spirit of the owl, and Tia looks at Dave, almost puzzled by how fine the photograph is. Perhaps she doubts he took it. He tells everyone the owl lives behind his house, which he figures is proof enough that he took it. A great horned owl, Tara announces. I did a report on owls last year. Everyone had to choose a different bird, and I picked owls. There are 130 different kinds of owls, and most of them hunt at night. They see better than we do, but when it's pitch black, they find mice by hearing them. They've got great ears, and their wings have really fluffy edges, so the mice can't hear them coming. Oh, I love owls, she says, looking closely at the photograph. Dave thinks she looks ready to cry. Somebody's here, Bobby says, as Greta opens the door. Greta, come in. Tia goes to the door and welcomes her with a hug. Greta's eyes are red and puffy, but she's happy to see Tia. Greta tells Tia quietly that she doesn't want to talk much. She's been through a crazy day, but is better now and ready for the moonwalk. She's had not only a crazy day, but a lunatic night, yet she knows Tia understands without having to hear the details about the bad dream of someone scratching under her bed or under the ice, someone stuck under the ice and all alone in the cold and clawing from far away. Yet when she awoke, it felt inside her, somewhere inside of her, but it didn't make sense, so Greta turned on the radio and listened to music while she waited for the night to end. At the first hint of dawn, she dressed, put on her new boots from Thunder Bay and her down parka, and drove straight to the cemetery. The snow was deep, and she sank in up to her thighs and ended up sitting on the McDonald family's tombstone, its top a platform the size of her kitchen table, and the only one not completely buried under snow. She sat and watched the sunrise turn the snowy cemetery rosy pink. She didn't cry. She wasn't scared. In fact, she felt safe for the first time since the scratching nightmare. When she was too cold to stay longer, she plodded her way out through the snow, drove back to the motel, and had a hearty breakfast. She changed, went to her favorite art gallery, to two bookstores, bought glass and some new tools, and then an expensive CD player. Took it all back to the motel, checked in for another date, and fell sound asleep at 1:30 in the afternoon. It was dark when she awoke. She cried all the way to the health food store. "It's funny, I'm all cried out. It feels so calm, so peaceful," she tells Tia. Tia takes her by the hand and makes introductions and mentions that Greta is not in a talkative mood tonight, more for Greta's sake than for anyone else's, since it's obvious to everyone that she has been crying and has been through some emotional turmoil. Priscilla gives Greta a cup of cider and thinks of her mom, who is often ultra dramatic when there's a full moon. Snowbird looks everyone over before they leave to see if anyone needs a scarf or heavier coat and to see if their boots are adequate for snowshoeing. They keep snowshoes in the old shed at the three-quarters point of the trail, where the snow is often too deep to get through without snowshoes or skis. Up to that point, Tia and the deer keep the trail open between moonwalks. Snowbird insists that Priscilla slip on a pair of heavy gray socks that come up to her knees. And then they are ready to start.
You've been listening to episode number 11, the next to the last episode of The Ice Dancer, written and read for us by Duluth author Connie Ellis. Remember, you can always go to our website at ktwh.org, and under the Programs tab is Literally from the North Shore, where you'll find the previous 2 weeks' recordings if you want to go back and hear something again or you missed something. Most, if not all, of the music accompanying this book is performed by Connie's husband Robert Ellis on piano from his CD titled Moonrise. Closing today with a short piece by Peter Sculthorpe titled Moon.